Monitor Monday is recorded before a live online audience. From the studios of Rack Monitor, this is Monitor Monday for April 8th, 2024. Here's today's rundown. The U.S. Department of Justice is cracking down on schemes allegedly perpetrated by Medicare Advantage plans to inflate patients' risk scores to get higher payments from the federal government. Dr. James Kennedy will report our lead story. We will also hear from healthcare attorneys Nicole Emanuel and David Glazer, plus Dr. Ronald Hirsch. Now here's the publisher of Rack Monitor and the host of Monitor Monday, Chuck Buck.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Monitor Monday. Today is solar eclipse day, a total solar eclipse. This morning, the total solar eclipse will make its way across North America from Mexico to Canada. And many of those who are fortunate to experience the total solar eclipse can expect, well, a drop in temperature. In some places, fish are expected to jump from the water. And then it's over at about 4 minutes of darkness. Monitor Monday correspondent David Glazer left his hometown of Minneapolis on a journey to experience the total solar eclipse. His risky business segment was previously recorded. The rest of the Monitor Monday crew is here and ready to go, and so we begin this morning with Dr. Ronald Hirsch. He's making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday.
Monday Rounds is sponsored by R1 Physician Advisory Solutions. Here now making his Monday rounds is Dr. Ronald Hirsch.
Well, good morning, all. First up for you today, a totally unsubstantiated rumor. Love them. A Texas hospital had heard that one of their regional Medicare Advantage plans is going to start requiring a 3-day inpatient stay to approve payment for a skilled nursing facility stay. Now, as many of you know, MA plans can waive this requirement, and most do, but I've never heard of a plan withdrawing the benefit. I also don't know if the plan must notify CMS and their beneficiaries of the change in the benefit package if they do withdraw the benefit, since many enrollees may have chosen that MA plan because they didn't want to be stuck with the traditional Medicare requirement. This will be interesting to watch, and I'm counting on Cynthia to keep me up to date on this down in Texas. Moving on, last month we talked about discharge appeal rights from patients without Medicare Part A. This week it's a different patient population, but the same issue. I'm sure everyone knows that patients who are not admitted as an inpatient do not have formal discharge appeal rights. But one hospital asked me why, when a few of their observation patients called the QIO to appeal their discharge, the QIO contacted them and asked for copies of the medical records to review. Now, my first question for them was, how in the world did the patient know to call the QIO? I mean, that's not a phone number most people keep on their cell phone. The QIO's phone number is not on the moon. So when they were placed in observation, they would have gotten the moon, but it doesn't have the number. So is it possible the patient received the important message from Medicare? Was somebody in their hospital taking a shortcut and simply getting signatures on every possible form, giving an IMM and a moon to every Medicare and Medicare Advantage patient who registered in the ED? Didn't even need to know whether they were going to be hospitalized. They gave them every piece of paper. Now, of course, we know this is not only inappropriate, but also not allowed. Medicare does not allow you to deliver a form to a patient that's not appropriate for their situation. This is a patient rights issue. And if you're surveyed in doing this, it's not going to be pretty. But putting that aside, what did happen here? Well, although the QIO cannot evaluate the patient as a formal discharge appeal, they also handle quality of care complaints. So they're really obligated to assess the patient's contention that they're being discharged prematurely, and asking for records would be part of that determination. So what should you do if this happens to you? Well, as always, the first thing to try and do is address the patient's concerns. Well, is the discharge premature? Has your physician advisor reviewed the case, spoken to the attending, and determined that discharge is appropriate? If there are no issues, then your next step would be to explain to the patient that they obviously have the right to call the QIO, but you've evaluated the situation and feel that discharge is appropriate. Then inform the patient that if they'd like to stay, they're welcome to do that, but it's not free and they must immediately start paying your hourly rate for custodial care, since there are no financial protections as there are with inpatient discharge appeals. Since custodial care is statutorily non-covered, you don't even need to give an advance beneficiary notice, but you'd be smart to do it because you really want written proof the patient understands their obligation. You can then go ahead and get a credit card number or have them Venmo you the first day or two of payment, since we know the QIO is not going to respond immediately. Wait, do hospitals accept Venmo? Well, they should in situations like this. And of course, be sure the patient's physician is aware of what's happening. And then you have to just sit back and wait for the QIO to call you. I'll remind you that if the physician has determined the patient doesn't need hospital care and the patient is staying, be sure there's no IV fluids ordered, no as-needed IV medications, and no testing ordered. If the QIO sees ongoing orders like this in the chart, they're going to think, well, perhaps the physician thinks the patient does need continued care, and they may decide to tell you to keep the patient. Now, can you evict the patient, forcibly make them leave if they won't cooperate with payment? Well, Medicare rules do not specifically prohibit that, but I'm going to leave that decision to your lawyers, as you should too. Thanks, Chuck. Back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Hirsch. That was the Vice President of R1, RCM, Ronald Hirsch, MD. Dr. Hirsch was making his Monday round here on Monitor Monday. Here now with the Monitor Monday RAC report is healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. And good morning, Nicole.
Hello, and happy RAC Monitor Monday. Yesterday, I was emailed a question from presumably a listener of Monitor Mondays, a Mr. Peter Young. He wanted to know whether I had commented on the nationwide audits of all inpatient rehabilitation facilities, or IRFs, that have been scheduled to occur throughout this year, 2024. Specifically, he asked, quote, OIG's work plan 2024 includes a national audit of IRF. To what degree are there knowns, actions by OIG, and has Nicole knowledge of any OIG IRF movement? And yeah, I think that there are knowns in any OIG IRF audit, just like it's a known that there will be a total eclipse today, depending on your location. IRFs provide intensive inpatient rehabilitation therapy for patients who have complex nursing, medical management, and rehabilitation needs that require hospital-level treatment in an inpatient environment. In fiscal year 2021, Medicare paid approximately $8.7 billion with a B, for 373,000 IRF stays nationwide. CMS has consistently found high IRF error rates through its comprehensive error rate testing program. For an IRF claim to be considered reasonable and necessary, it must meet certain coverage and documentation requirements. CMS issued a nationwide audit of IRF claims in September 2018, and many of the IRF facility stays did not meet Medicare coverage and documentation requirements. That was found in A-01-15-00500. They found that medical record documentation for 175 of the 220 sampled IRF stays did not support that the IRF care was reasonable and necessary in accordance with Medicare requirements. CMS hospital compliance audits also frequently include IRF claims and have similarly found high error rates. In response to these findings, IRF stakeholders have stated that Medicare audit contractors and OIG have misconstrued the IRF coverage regulations, which is true, I have seen in many of the audits. OIG has stated that it does need to get more information from IRF stakeholders, and it does plan to determine where the areas of where CMS can clarify, you know, claim IRF claims payment criteria. According to a source I found on the internet, which we all know is not 100%, but it was a CMS site, there are 1,225 IRFs in the country. Now, I'm not sure whether that's accurate or not, but if it is, I wonder whether CMS or its contracted vendors can complete an audit of 100% of IRFs in a year. I mean, maybe CMS doesn't expect to. This CMS website also lists all general information of every IRF, a list of all IRFs with data on the number of times people with Medicare who had certain medical conditions were treated in the past year, national data on the quality of patient care measures shown on the IRF Compare, and a list of IRF facilities with data on the quality of patient care measures shown on the Inpatient Rehabilitation Facility Compare. The issues that I just raised, patient care, whether certain conditions were treated, as well as readmittance, will be prime targets for IRF audits. Medical necessity and eligibility criteria will also be prime targets. Now, on March 27, 2024, CMS issued a proposed rule that provides proposals for the fiscal year 2025 Inpatient Rehabilitation Facility Quality Reporting Program, or the IRFQRP. This proposed rule includes four new assessment items in the social determinants of health category: one, living situation; two, food; and three, utilities. CMS is also proposing to modify the transportation item and remove the admission class item from the IRF patient assessment instrument. We'll have fun watching the eclipse, regardless of your location. I remember the last eclipse in 2017, which was only a partial. It'll be a partial for me in North Carolina again. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Nicole. That was healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. Nicole is a partner in the law firm of Nelson Mullins. And coming up in about 10 minutes after the hour in your time zone, you're going to hear from healthcare attorney David Glazer and Dr. James Kennedy. He's standing by to report our AIDS story. It's Monday. It's April the 8th. It's total solar eclipse day. And you're listening to the live edition of Monitor Monday. Stand by.
This is for you, healthcare professional. Are you looking for the latest coding and compliance updates and insights? How about wanting to fulfill your CEU requirements? Look no further than the MedLearn Media Resource Center. Dive into the curated collection of resources crafted by industry leaders from our three top-rated publishers, MedLearn Publishing, Rack Monitor, and ICD-10 Monitor. From articles and webinars to interactive workshops and downloadable guides, discover a diverse range of content to fuel your continuous growth. For a single low annual subscription, all your teams will have convenient one-stop access to the complete libraries of three trusted brands: MedLearn Publishing, ICD-10 Monitor, and Rack Monitor. One low monthly cost, unlimited access, and all the CEUs you need. It's the MedLearn Media Resource Center. Increase your knowledge with workable coding solutions and actionable answers so you can put the focus back on patient care with the MedLearn Media Resource Center.
Here now with the Monitor Money Risky Business Report is healthcare attorney David Glazer. David, what could be risky this morning?
Well, Chuck, it's the risk that there will be a hiccup with the recording. This is taped so I can chase the eclipse. Hopefully right now I'm in Mount Vernon, Illinois. So in the vein of the eclipse, let's talk about what happens in the shadows. I've worked on dozens of False Claims Act investigations, and I think that there were only two of them where the folks in compliance knew about the issue before getting notice from the government. Even in a small healthcare entity, it's difficult to know what everyone is doing. But it's in the increasingly common gigantic healthcare organizations, staying on top of everything is just inconceivable. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. Post-eclipse, sunlight returns without any affirmative act by us humans. But bringing light to the darkened portions of your organization will take more work. One strategy I've mentioned for years, but still see few organizations do, is a semi-annual certification. Now, this is a major undertaking as it requires contacting every employee in the organization. They must all certify either that they're not aware of any issues that should be investigated by compliance, or alternatively, that they're disclosing the situation which compliance should review. Now, the reason I want to do every employee is that even janitors sometimes see things, right? It's not just medical professionals who notice wrongdoing. Now, the process is going to yield lots of red herrings, but it will also help you spot trouble early. Perhaps just as importantly, it makes it difficult for someone to falsely claim that they've raised issues for years when they really haven't. Whistleblowers often have conveniently selective memories. So another strategy is to mimic the incentive approach used in the False Claims Act. Offer bonuses to employees who notify compliance about potentially problematic situations. You have the discretion to be generous, offering rewards to anyone who acts in good faith, regardless of whether their fears prove valid. But perhaps the most important thing you can do is be very visible. Your compliance team should have friends throughout the organization. Talk to people. Ask them what they worry about. While it's very rare that I've had situations where compliance knew the details of a particular problem before the False Claims Act case was brought, it's much more common for compliance to have had some difficult to articulate but omnipresent suspicions about the department or the professionals involved. So the trick is to get enough information to convert this innuendo into actual knowledge. So I've had a number of times in life where I've had to decide whether to report something. And from that, I've learned to have sympathy for people who are hesitant to pick up the phone. There's a fear of being judged, whether it's being called a tattletale or being called a fool. Let's say one of your people knows about a phlebotomist who's been provided, they think, by an outside laboratory. The employee isn't sure about the payment terms. Maybe we're paying for them, maybe we're not. They may fear that if they raise the question, they'll discover that everything was fully vetted and that they're just crying wolf and that will be embarrassing. They might think that they're going to get in trouble with their boss. Your goal is to tip the scales in favor of reporting. Offering encouragement and rewards can help. Now, Chuck, you may think that since I'm talking about what we do in the shadows and phlebotomy, the drawing of blood, I'm going to go with the theme from the very funny TV show about vampires, What We Do in the Shadows. But you're wrong. You're dead wrong. You're dead wrong. Given the eclipse, I can't resist the pun of Carly Simon's You're So Vain. Now, hopefully, I don't have to go all the way to Nova Scotia to see the total eclipse of the sun, because I'm starting off in southern Illinois. Back to you.
Very good, David. Thank you very much. That was Oscar attorney David Glazer. David is a shareholder of the law firm of Fredrickson & Byron in downtown Minneapolis.
Are you looking for a better way to manage risk assessments? Are you familiar with CERT? CERT is the Comprehensive Error Rate Testing Program. You can leverage the CERT to create your own internal coding and billing risk assessment plan. And RAC Monitor's senior healthcare analyst, Frank Cohen, will show you how to leverage the Comprehensive Error Rate Testing Program to create your own internal coding and billing risk assessment plan. The webcast, Leveraging the CERT, a new coding and billing risk assessment plan with Frank Cohen, is tomorrow, April 9th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. Register now at the RAC University Bookstore.
Now it's time for our lead story with Dr. James Kennedy, and he's going to be reporting on how the government is cracking down on Medicare Advantage players who are being prosecuted for non-compliant billing. And good morning, Dr. Kennedy. Welcome to Monitor Money. And Jim, this is a big story, and I'm thinking about Cigna and the 37 million dollar settlement regarding their alleged manipulations of risk adjusted scores. You know, last week on Monitor Money, famed whistleblower Mary Inman reported that the U.S. Department of Justice had joined a whistleblower lawsuit that accused Martin's Point Healthcare, along with five other providers, of defrauding the government of more than $300 million. This is pertaining to allegations that the providers had inflated patients' risk scores to obtain higher payments to which they were not entitled. So what's your reaction to that, Dr. Kennedy?
Well, I tell you what, Chuck, this is a not just with Med Advantage plans. This issue of scheming is now trickling over into traditional Medicare and affecting hospitals that employ physicians and physician groups. Sure, we've heard about the Kaiser Kieton, you know, which is still being put off. We know about the Cigna case where the Cigna had to pay $23 million. There was another Kieton against Adlaide, which is involving physician ACOs, IPAs, and the like. But what most of us don't realize is that the individual doctor can be, quote, part of a scheme, end quote, because we know now the diagnosis codes that are submitted on physician claims affect cost efficiency models under the merit-based incentive payment system or other CMS-sanctioned alternative payment models in traditional Medicare. Now, in order to try to get this or to address this, a number of hospitals or facilities have licensed technology. And this is technology asking physicians to add diagnoses to their problem list or to add diagnoses to their diagnostic statements. However, in my personal opinion, these technologies are promoting non-compliance with the ICD-10 official guidelines because in the outpatient environment, which the rules in outpatient are different than inpatient, we cannot code a chronic condition in an outpatient environment unless the doctor documents that care was rendered for that chronic condition. Just simply listing a diagnosis in the diagnostic statement or just listing a medication that the patient's on, like insulin for a diabetic, is not care unless the doctor is more explicit about this. Now, we've all heard of MEET, M-E-A-T, monitored, evaluated, assessed, or treated. In my personal opinion, just saying that a condition is stable is probably not enough because the doctor has to show how he or she came to that conclusion. So what brought this to my attention last week is a best practice advisory from a major EMR company, whom I think you all know who that is. And they were asking, they would send a note to a physician and say, the patient came in for like an ankle sprain. And so in this best practice advisory to an orthopedic surgeon, they'll say, hey, orthopod, the patient was diagnosed 2 years ago with major depression. Or they'll say, hey, orthopedic surgeon, this patient was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And nobody has redocumented major depression or type 1 diabetes. Can we add these diagnoses to the diagnostic statement? Well, the doctor will say, sure, I'll add those things to the diagnostic statement. And this EMR company then takes those two diagnoses and puts it on the claim. And then that goes out to the payer. And, of course, that risk adjusts, you know, for that population. I would want to recommend to everybody that they look at a couple of coding clinics. And I've put these in the chat, but I'm going to just say this to you right now. Let me get this here. Coding Clinic, second quarter, 2022, page 30. Coding Clinic, third quarter, 2021, page 32 to 33. Let me get this again. Coding Clinic, third quarter, 2020, page 33, and Coding Clinic, third quarter, 2019, pages 5 through 6. These have to be read thoroughly. And the caution that we have is that if a physician puts a diagnosis in the medical record, they've got to show how that diagnosis affected the care that occurred during that encounter on an outpatient environment. And in my opinion, because these False Claims Acts, anything that influences reimbursement, remember under traditional MIPS, merit-based incentive payment system, cost efficiency is is 2.7% plus or minus of that physician's traditional Medicare professional fees. So if there is a pattern of technology queries, this or that, to add diagnoses to a claim, and the doctor doesn't show that that diagnosis affected the reason for the patient being there or the circumstances, then that's going to be a red flag in my mind that I think can generate compliance risk. Other references that I would like to ask that you look at, of course, the ICD-10 official guidelines. Read those as it relates to the chronic to outpatient conditions. Read the AHIMA compliant clinical documentation integrity standards. This goes into the differences between a documentation alert, which is to influence billing, versus a clinical alert, which influences care. And then, of course, the AHIMA ACDIS 2022 query practice brief, which is governing how these technologies should work. I guarantee you, if you talk this over with your compliance officer, you look at these queries, you look at these best practice advisories, I think that you may, and remember, a good lawyer knows the law, the better lawyer knows the law, the judge and the jury. Don't fall under the false claims trap. Thank you so much, Chuck. Back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Kennedy. That was Dr. James Kennedy. Dr. Kennedy is the president of CDIMD, and Dr. Kennedy is a frequent guest on Talking Tuesdays. As a matter of fact, he's going to be on our broadcast next Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, tomorrow. Dr. Hirsch, we've got a couple of minutes. Let's answer some questions or some comments that have been coming in during our live broadcast, okay?
Sure. Well, the first thing I thought was very interesting is that Nicole calls it IRF, and Dr. Kennedy was calling it AHIMA. I call them IRF and AHIMA. I don't know what that says about me or them, but it's kind of interesting. The other thing Nicole's segment brought up to me, and we talk about the inpatient rehab denials. I think one of the most underused resources in hospitals are your physiatrists, right? If I have a stroke and I'm hospitalized, I certainly want a neurologist on my case. But the sooner you can get the physiatrist involved in the care to help plan for the short and long-term recovery, the better outcome your patient is going to have. And they're going to help document properly requirements for inpatient rehab facility care. Now, a quick question for James, Dr. Kennedy, sorry. You know, with the HCC issue, a lot of us on this call deal with inpatient versus observation.
Right.
We have a lot of inpatient claims that get denied by Medicare Advantage plans.
Right.
Let's say one of those claims has an HCC on it. Right. We submit the inpatient claim. The MA plan takes it and processes and sucks the codes out of it and sends them off to CMS. But if they deny the inpatient admission, do they go back to CMS and say, oops, we shouldn't have reported that code because we're not paying the hospital for an inpatient admission because we didn't think the code was valid?
That's a great question. And it's always interesting to me how this all works. But let me just say, if it's the intent of the provider to have submitted a claim as an inpatient, and in fact, the order is in the record as an inpatient, then the inpatient rules apply as opposed to the outpatient rules. So that, again, now if the hospital self-denies condition 44s it, you know, before the claim goes out, then right. The outpatient rules, you know, apply.
Let's say sepsis is on the claim and the insurance comes back and says, no, they didn't have sepsis. We'll pay the inpatient, but we're not paying sepsis. Do you think that they're actually not reporting sepsis to Medicare?
I think they are. I think they're double dipping. In my opinion, they're just making that a coverage decision, but they're going to still submit it to CMS for the risk adjustment. So they're telling the provider that the diagnosis of sepsis is invalid. Then they're claiming it's valid for risk adjustment for their side. I think that's evil. That's extremely evil. And if I was the Department of Justice, I'd go off after that. I mean, that's crazy.
Some say that evil and Medicare Advantage is redundant, but we're not going to go there today.
Well, Med Advantage has certain benefits, and I'm grateful for that. The challenge comes again to how do we, you know, these schemes, how do we properly report our patients' conditions, and how do we fund these plans so that they can provide care? It's a very, very challenging circumstance.
Thanks, Chuck. Back to you.
Thanks, Dr. Hirsch, and thank you, Dr. Kennedy. And that is going to be a wrap for this live edition of Monitor Monday. And we thank you so very much for being with us today. And a special thank you to our panelists today, Nicole Emanuel, David Glazer, Dr. Ronald Hirsch, and, of course, Dr. James Kennedy, who reported our lead story. And one more thing before we go, be sure to be with me tomorrow on Talk to Tuesday. We've got a great program lined up. And also, Dr. James Kennedy is going to be reporting live from the ACTIS conference. Have a great day, everybody, and be sure to watch carefully the solar eclipse if you're going to be watching it at all. Goodbye now.
Monitor Monday is a presentation of Rack Monitor.